And that's the kicky music that means it is time once again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Today on the show, we're going to get into a topic near and dear to the hearts of anyone who likes to talk about himself or herself. We'll talk about what we like about them, what we don't like about them, and perhaps name some that we like and do not like so much. This is also going to be our last show before Thanksgiving, so we thought we would get a little bit of a turkey theme going. And specifically, we're going to talk about pop culture side dishes. We're going to breeze through a few very quick corrections that some of you may have noted recently, and then, as always, we're going to talk about what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let me introduce everybody. Stephen Thompson is back from staycationing.
So very rested and from a week of doing the same things I always do.
And what do you do at NPR, Stephen?
Well, I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movies editor at NPR.org. I pick Twitter fights and I get my queens mixed up.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm awfully glad to have the entire crew around the table again. We're going to talk a little bit about memoirs. Now, there is a memoir in the news. I think, Glenn, you were the one who brought it up.
Yep.
Talk a little bit about what got you thinking about this.
Yeah, I read God, If You're Not Up There, I'm Effed, the NPR-approved title, by Daryl Hammond, the impressionist from SNL, served on SNL for like 10 years, I think. He calls himself an impressionist and not an impersonator. You know what the difference is, anyone?
I do not.
I have your feeling you're going to tell us.
According to him, an impressionist does many characters, an impersonator does only one.
I see. So, like, if you're an Elvis impersonator.
Exactly.
I get it.
So, this memoir, you know, he's been through some terrible, awful things at the hands of a very vindictive mother and a very distant father. He lost some very close friends to suicide in ways that left him with a harrowing sense of guilt. And the book has the tone of self-lacerating ruefulness that an addict has, because he is certainly that. He's merciless about himself. He's eager to tell you all his hitting bottom stories. He's got plenty of them, like an addict is wont to do. Mm-hmm. But even though he's kind of a jock, it doesn't come off as the chest-thumping nobility and suffering kind of memoir. You know, he's not Bukowski. He's not, I woke up at a pool of my own vomit because I'm a poet. You know,
right.
He's not that guy.
Yep.
And it's not the David Carr Night of the Gun kind of memoir.
No, it's not. I mean, he's very honest about the quality of the material he was doing before SNL found him. It was not high.
Yeah.
It was kind of hacky. He calls it cheap. The word he uses is cheap. And the backstage stuff is interesting, but it's not a tell-all in any sense of the term. He takes pride in not really knowing politics or taking a side, which makes the book lack a sort of bite.
Right.
It was passable. I guess it was a good memoir. I have a disdain for memoir in its form. We'll talk about it later, but first I want to go around the room and see what some of the other books you guys have enjoyed.
Sure.
Oh, wow.
Trey?
I wasn't quite sure that I wanted to start with principles and look for examples, so I just thought of two books that I did enjoy tremendously and tried to work backward and discover a couple of principles.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought of Joan Didion's Year of Magical Thinking, which lays bare some, you know, intensely personal stuff. And it certainly doesn't stint on feeling. But the thing that struck me about it, both on the page and in the stage version, the solo show that she turned it into, is that it has an incredibly clear perspective on its own events. There's a passage where, in the moments after the sudden collapse and death of her husband, John Gregory Dunn, she's calling the New York Times and the LA Times because she thinks, being Joan Didion, that it would be very bad form of her to let the LA Times learn about Dunn's death from the New York Times. And it's not a situation most
right.
people would have to confront.
Right.
And she is keenly aware of the absurdity of this situation and of the absurdity of what she's feeling, but it's also very real and very personal to her. And it's probably the clearest evocation of shock, as in I am in shock and operating on autopilot,
right.
than I can think of in this kind of thing.
Right.
And so that struck me. And then the other book that I thought about immediately was a book called Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, which is Alexandra Fuller's memoir of her time growing up as a kid in what was first Rhodesia and then became Zimbabwe while she was a kid. You know, civil war, the struggle for majority rule in what had been a white-ruled country. And again, there's this remarkable clarity about who her family is and who she is. They're living in this country where racism is quite literally institutional, and they are wholeheartedly invested in that system. The adult distance that marks the analysis in the book is woven really tightly with a passion for those people and that place that's really just scorchingly felt in the prose. And so those two things, a clear sense of self, I think, the sense that you understand yourself with at least a little bit of distance and maybe even some irony, mm-hmm. and a vivid sense of place and some level of real care for the places and the people that you're remembering yourself among.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those seem like very reasonable choices and good principles to draw from them, I think.
Cool.
Stephen Thompson.
We've talked briefly about this book before, and obviously, you know, all sorts of disclaimers that this book is written by a dear friend of mine, but I did want to throw out a mention of The Big Rewind, uh-huh. which is the memoir of Nathan Rabin, who is the head writer of the AV Club, and just like I said, disclaimer, I'm mentioned in the book.
You are.
I'm cited as great.
so that's a principle that we
I
can
think
distill.
The first principle.
Any book that talks about you.
Of
any
great
book
memoir.
That says I'm awesome.
Exactly. It should be hailing me in some way.
Just welcome back, Thompson.
My concern now is that if I make a wrap it up, move it along sign with my arms, it won't be audible and everyone out there will not know I'm doing it and will wonder why I'm not doing it. Go ahead.
I also want to throw out a mention and thank a listener named Ariel Braverman for reminding me of a book called Ice on Ice, which is the absolutely hilarious Vanilla Ice autobiography. If I may read briefly from the back jacket.
Do please.
Nobody's hotter than the ice. Sweet vanilla, heavenly body in motion, rocking the crowd and rocking it loud. Yo, check it out. The Ice Age is here.
Wow.
That said, to briefly touch on principles based on the good mm-hmm. memoir that I have read, The Big Rewind mm-hmm. by Nathan Rabin, I think it's really important for a good memoir, and I know there are exceptions to this rule, but for me, there's a pair of qualities. Candor and the lack of an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously we're in Washington, D.C. I've read some political autobiographies.
Right.
And they are almost always, I mean, just stultifying because they're right. obviously not going to reveal anything shocking unless it is something that is designed to generate press. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't believe the president's position on Libya, you know.
Uh-huh.
and the interviews I find most interesting tend to be of less famous people who have less of a reason not to offend anyone. And it's not that I'm right. dying for someone to take all sorts of cheap shots. I mean,
right.
Lord knows Joe Esterhaas takes a bunch of cheap shots in his autobiography that I don't wish to read.
Right.
But somebody who is not, you know, a massive star who has an image
right.
to painstakingly...
Current marketability
to maintain, I find that much more interesting. And it's something that really comes through in, for example, Nathan's book, it is a fearlessness. And, you know, there's a certain amount, you know, with a lot of these things, I'm sure this is true of the Daryl Hammond book, where there's a little bit of, ooh, I don't know that I needed to know that.
Right,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I would rather the person err on the side of revealing too much than revealing too little.
Yeah. I think in memoir there's a greater propensity toward preciousness, you know. If somebody hasn't really done the work of self-exploration, there's a
sure.
tendency to preciousness, to defensiveness, to the airing of grievances. You don't get a 360-degree view because that's not what they're trying to get you. They're trying to
right.
make you crawl inside their head for a while.
Right.
The thing that sets the Hammond book apart is that because he's been through the process, he's been through the program several times, AA, he now realizes that his self-destructiveness also hurts others.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not stuck in that word like, look at me, I'm a bad boy.
Right.
Or let me tell you how screwed up I got.
He's not describing the bad things that he's done as if, like, you know, kind of, he's not glamorizing them.
Exactly. He kind of understands what they can teach him about himself, and he doesn't do it in a very AA way. So
yeah. Trey, of course, mentioned David Carr's The Night of the Gun, which David Carr is a writer for the New York Times. He has become something of a celebrity in recent years, a media celebrity, both through this book and through, he was one of the main people featured in the documentary Page One about the New York Times. David Carr was a drug addict for a very long time. He was an alcoholic more recently. He has been sober for a few years and wrote this book in which he attempts as a journalist to go back and essentially reconstruct his own past. The problem with that being, I think it's a fundamentally well-intentioned, good faith, bogus enterprise. If you go back and interview people who love you and ask them how bad it was, they're not going to tell you. And I think he honestly believes he's freeing those people to tell him how bad it was.
Right.
Wow.
And I don't think they can. I don't think you can expect that people who care about you are really going to tell you how bad it was. What they will do is pour on a lot of stuff about how well-intentioned you were and the things that were still together about you and the things
Or how good you are now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so the first part of the memoir, when he describes this harrowing life as a drug addict, I actually found quite moving and quite harrowing. But his redemption arc is very hard to read for me because it's a lot of quoting people telling him how great he is. And it's really uncomfortable for me. But ultimately, as much as I would like to have my objections be strictly to that structural problem, the real problem to me is the amount of swagger in the book.
Right.
Yeah.
And it is his personality. I don't think there's any way that he could have avoided it. And I don't think it makes him a terrible guy. And I don't think it makes him dishonest. Partly because his writing is incredibly evocative and vivid. It is a beautifully written book. It is almost like the old Truffaut quote about how you can't make a true anti-war movie because it glamorizes war just to put it on the screen.
Mm.
If you write an incredibly vivid, fascinating book about your life as a drug addict, your life as a drug addict, especially if it ends with, and now it's all fine, comes off as thinking that that life was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And that's problematic for me.
It's kind of a curse for that guy. At full disclosure, he used to be the editor of the Washington City Paper, where I have for a long time contributed theater reviews. And I know him a little bit, but he's an incredibly talented editor and writer. And in some ways, he is that guy. He's he is a swagger. He's a big, brash personality.
Right.
And always was.
Right.
So, yeah, the intersection of those two things is problematic on the page.
And for addiction memoirs, I would contrast that one with two that I like a great, great deal, one of which is Craig Ferguson's memoir, American on Purpose, which is not strictly about his alcoholism. He doesn't actually spend a tremendous amount of time on that. But he talks about being in treatment, although his treatment of rehab in the book is really to sort of say, I don't really need to tell you the specific details of rehab because it's kind of not, it's not going to be that interesting to you. You can read about rehab lots of places. But I did want to read you a passage where he speaks after he has been to rehab and he is trying to make amends, speaking to his ex-wife. The most difficult move I had to make, the one that I dreaded more than any other, was contacting Anne. I just felt so rotten about how I had treated her. I didn't know where I would find the nerve to call her and couldn't begin to guess how she'd react. Fate forced my hand in the end. Walking home from the BBC one day, I turned a corner and there she was. I asked if she had time for a coffee and she said, of course. We went to a nearby cafe and I laid it all out, told her how I felt about having been such a prick and how badly I wanted to make it up to her, to make it right between us. She started crying. Then she told me she was happy I had found a better way to live and didn't feel I was totally to blame for the failure of our marriage, a staggering notion that I, in my self-obsession, had not considered. Anne said that she had been so wrapped up in her desire to settle down and build a family that she couldn't or wouldn't see how crazy I was, how incapable of giving her what she wanted. She still cared for me, and the best way I could make amends to her was to be happy. I do have a knack for finding great women. And there is a generosity in this book toward everyone he has ever dealt with that is absolutely, it is really beautiful to see. You can tell from the book that there has been some give and take in the bad treatment. He is nothing but lovely about them, particularly women that he has dated and known. And the other book is called Basketball Junkie, and it's by Chris Herron. It was ghostwritten by a sports writer named Bill Reynolds. And Chris Herron was an NBA player, not gigantic star, but he had been a huge high school star. He joined the NBA. He was a heroin addict. He had been a drug addict for quite a long time, had had all kinds of problems in college. That had come out. He was supposedly all better now, then was in the NBA. And this book is an absolutely harrowing story about addiction. I mean, his story is much more recent. And it's incredibly humble. It lacks all of that swagger. It has nothing but sort of true regret and sadness and feeling nothing but gross about sort of all these wasted opportunities and what he put his wife through. And so in terms of addiction memoirs, I think what I look for is a certain amount of humility, although they are not as technically accomplished writers, I don't think. Those books, I think, contain greater insight. And so it's an interesting trade-off. In some ways, the David Carr book is a more thrilling read, but these other books, I think, have greater insight.
Well, when I said before about how I prefer that there not be an agenda, and you mentioned briefly sort of grinding axes and stuff, I think a companion to that argument is the lack of self-aggrandizement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, full disclosure, I stood next to David Carr at a concert once. Didn't talk to him, but, you know, I just thought I'd put it out there. You know, I think that that's really important.
May I take this little conversation to do a bit of a detour? May I wax pedantic?
By all means.
It's my favorite thing.
We would expect no less.
I got a 65 Pontiac Pedantic out back. Can I wax it? May I wax it for some cherry red?
God.
All right. I have the fiction reader and the fiction writer's distrust, disdain for memoir. At the lowest level, it's because they sell way more than fiction does.
Mm-hmm.
Way more, and I hate that. Also, the name, memoir, pretentious.
Yeah.
This is
memoir.
Right there.
Memoir.
I am old enough to remember when, you know who used to write memoirs? Presidents, statesmen, soldiers, not narrow-chested art professors whose mommy yelled at them once.
Narrow-chested art professors. They're not all narrow-chested.
They're not all. It's particularly galling to me because when I say the term
As a
large barrel-chested man. When I say the term graphic novel, people will think of books like Mouse, Persepolis, Fun Home, Cancer Vixen, all of which are...
Memoirs.
Memoirs. They're not novels. They're not comic novels. They're graphic memoirs. So I don't have that frisson that people get from memoir. Speaking
really
of pretentious.
Don't. You really don't get
that. I was going to say, you think the word memoir is
pretentious? I've talked to people who say, I prefer memoir. I prefer it because it actually happened. Fiction people just make that up. And that, to me, is galling. Because here's the pedantic part. Strap in. The novel engages the imagination to find truth, while the memoir relies on memory. But my thing is, there's no difference between those two things.
Of course not.
People say that memory is about facts. It's not. It's about emotions. You remember certain things because of the emotions that accrete around them. You forget certain things because strong emotions don't. So those emotions shape and distort the facts.
Yeah,
and
I was going to say, you rewrite the memories as you're putting them on the page. It's, you know,
so this is why
the line between fiction and memoir is famously thin.
Exactly. So this is why I've mellowed a little bit, because memoirs are fiction. The act of approaching something as messy and as complicated as human life and imposing a narrative on it, even if it's a purely boring chronological narrative.
And when you're applying that narrative to your own life.
Exactly.
Right.
That's an act of fiction. Choosing to depict certain scenes rather than others simply because those scenes carry weight, finding connections, unearthing themes, telling a story, that's fiction. I personally get more truth out of a Marilyn Robinson novel or an Alice Munro story than any memoir I've ever read or ever will read. Because the truth that you encounter in novels has nothing to do with accuracy. Memoirs are beholden to them. They get dinged when they aren't perfectly accurate, which I think is a waste of time. Like when somebody goes after Augustine Burroughs, or most ridiculously, most famously, David Sedaris.
Right.
In 2007, David Hurd wrote a piece in the New Republic, this very long, sniffy, hilariously tone-deaf expose. It's just this what he called an expose of Sedaris' work. He's conflating it with journalism. So, I mean, accuracy is for journalists. It's for accountants. It's not for...
Wow. That was said with some serious disdain.
There was some mild condescension encoded in that word.
But this is the thing. I read fiction because I want to crawl into somebody else's head and look around and then be able to kind of go to somebody else's head and get a 360-degree view. And that's not what memoir is for. Memoir is to kind of take you and trap you inside this one dude's
head.
But
here's my question. You love documentaries, right?
Yeah, sure.
Don't you feel that a particularly well-made documentary can be more dramatically rich than, you know, much... you know, sort of narrative drama.
But how many first-person documentaries about the filmmaker have you ever particularly enjoyed?
See, that's it. I think the
I was working on a theory.
No, it's a solid one. And the reason I've backed off of this position a little bit, even though it doesn't sound like I have, is because the literary memoir strikes me as a little bit different, because good writing will out. I can remember reading and loving Mary Carr's The Liar's Club a long time ago, Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life, because that is not about mere journaling, which I've read too many novels are like, you know, about addiction, about abuse, mere going off about, you know, your feelings.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see what
here we go.
We're
back to that.
But it's about creating language, finding truth in a way with skill.
Well, and I think it's important to point out that not all memoirs are serious painful, agonizing looks at some serious problems such as addiction or abuse or something like that. And I will name four that I wrote down that I will just rattle off
that are fun,
in addition to Ice on Ice.
Tina Fey's Bossy Pants.
That are fun. Oh, okay. That would be another one.
Five.
Here are these four. Notes from the Underwire, which is by Quinn Cummings, who was an actress who was nominated when she was like 8 years old for an Academy Award for The Goodbye Girl. Mm-hmm. She has become a very funny writer. Confessions of a Prairie Bitch by Alison Arngrim, who played Nellie Olson on Little House on the Prairie. That is a greatly funny, silly book. It contains many kind of bitchy stories about growing up on Little House on the Prairie with those actors and actresses and stuff like that. Great. Anthony Bourdain, Kitchen Confidential.
Yes,
if you've never read Kitchen Confidential, for God's sake, do yourself a favor. It's a lot of fun. There are a couple of follow-ups to it.
And if nothing else, it will teach you when not to eat brunch.
Absolutely true. What to order on what day.
Yep. Was it hollandaise sauce?
I forget. But there are some pretty harrowing kitchen stories. And finally, another food book by Nigel Slater called Toast, which is also fantastic and which I love. So if you're looking for lighter memoir, those are four that I would recommend that don't get you into this sort of miserable situation. So,
well done.
Anyway, what I would take away from this discussion is we're not going to be reading Glenn's memoir.
Nope.
Nope. It's called My Feelings by Glenn.
And isn't that a pity? Feel free to come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. Tell us about how you feel about memoir in general and perhaps name some that you would like to share with the group. As you may be able to tell, we don't always like to talk about our feelings. And so as we come up on Thanksgiving, we did not feel that we were going to do a big round of, kissy face gratitude and all the things you're thankful for.
Oh, God, because, you know, giving thanks is so passé.
Because giving thanks is
so passé to like people.
You scoff, but that's,
yeah. Glenn's like, you're finally coming around.
That's right.
So we thought that we would maybe take another spin on Thanksgiving and talk a little bit about side dishes. And, you know, as you know about Thanksgiving, what are the side dishes too?
The turkey.
Mm-hmm. So we were going to look for some side dishes, namely aspects perhaps of something in general we think is a turkey, but the side dish makes it worthwhile. Glenn Weldon, what is your favorite...
Speaking of turkey.
Oh, that's nice.
Incidentally, as an introduction, what is your favorite literal side dish?
Would be a sausage stuffing.
Sausage stuffing? All right. And what is your pop culture side dish?
All right, so I'm not going to sit here and tell you guys that 1984's Supergirl, the movie, is a good film.
Phew.
Am I going to tell you that it's made...
I would actually kind of like it if you did.
That it's made better by Faye Dunaway and Brenda Vaccaro.
Yes.
Camping it up as witches? Yes, I'm going to tell you that. I'm not going to tell you that Three Amigos is anything but dumb fun. It's not a turkey by any stretch of the imagination. It's a fun film. When people talk about this movie, they usually go on about the My Little Buttercup dance scene, mm-hmm. or the scene where they're trying to break into a movie studio, or the villain asking his henchman about whether or not he'd say he has a plethora of piñatas. But for me, there's a small scene at a party in a Mexican village which makes this film. I couldn't find it online, but let me tell you about it. It's late at night. Martin Short's character is telling a story to a bunch of village children who don't speak English, so they have no idea what he's saying. And he's telling a story about the time he met Dorothy Gish, sister of Lillian.
Wow.
It's in there for me. There's no point to it. It's just fantastic. I am going to tell you, however, that Love at First Bite, notice how none of these films are like in the last three decades. It's a silly little, incredibly dated 1979 piece of fluff.
George Hamilton.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Right?
Yes. Susan St. James.
Susan St. James.
Susan St. James. Way too many casually racist jokes for comfort, but this movie comes alive when Richard Benjamin as Jeffrey Rosenberg, the great-grandson of Fritz Van Helsing. In this scene, he has just attempted to kill Dracula in a hotel room, and he's being rushed to Bellevue Hospital and explaining to the EMTs who Dracula is while they prepare a sedative.
See, he's a vampire. He's got to be destroyed. He's filth. Decadence, yeah. He's unclean. He's got to be destroyed. And you know what I think? I'm not sure about this, but I just suspect that he's better in bed with my girl than I am!
This guy's really flipped.
Who's that for? Huh? It's not for me. Get the air bubble out.
And I just want to say that I did pull this movie up on IMDb, and in addition to the people we've already talked about, it also contains Dick Shawn, Artie Johnson, and Sherman Hemsley Isabel Sanford.
Wow.
Yes. Yes.
So that is very impressive.
Remember when I said casually racist? That's the racist scene.
But that is an impressive cast.
One last one. This is the one I really want to direct people's attention
to.
I am going to tell you that the infamous flop Ishtar, starring Dustin Hoffman and a just pre-bloat Warren Beatty, has some pretty funny scenes in it. All of those scenes revolve around Beatty and Hoffman writing terrible songs. Mm-hmm. The film isn't good, and it shouldn't have cost the money it did. But the best scenes are very intimate. They don't cost anything, because mm-hmm. it's just these two actors sitting around a piano writing earnest, terrible songs, which were actually written by Paul Williams, director Elaine May, and Dustin Hoffman himself.
Telling the truth is a dangerous tunnel.
When you get out of that tunnel,
it's a bitter herb. Life ahead. Forget herb. I never heard of a hit that had the word herb in it.
Telling the truth is a dangerous
thing. Dangerous!
Telling the truth can be dangerous.
What?
Why?
Telling the truth can be dangerous business. Because if yourself, because you if don't you know why.
Huh?
Well, I'm just giving you what the idea is. Telling the truth can be dangerous business. If you don't know yourself, then you don't know why.
Oh, is that brilliant?
Telling the truth can be dangerous business. Honest and popular don't go hand in hand. If you admit that you can play the accordion, no one will hire you in a rock and roll band.
But we can't sing.
We can sing our hearts out. Lucky
with
no neighbors complain.
Look at that. Simon and Garfunkel's greatest hits.
While Dangerous Business is as good as anything they ever wrote.
You think so?
Sure. The only thing that Simon and Garfunkel or Bruce Springsteen or any of these guys have that we don't have is an agent.
You think so?
Dangerous Business is as good as Bridge Over Troubled Water any day of the week.
So check it out.
Let the record Ishtar. Show that there was a certain amount of head bobbing going on the Weldon side of the
Absolutely.
Table.
Well done, Catchy. Glenn. Well done, Glenn. Well done.
So your recommendation is that we check out Ishtar?
Ishtar?
Uh-huh. I am.
And you thought he didn't have a big heart. Trey Graham.
I would just like to say that two things on Glenn Weldon's agenda that overlapped with mine are a reference to a Gish sister and a reference to Ishtar. What are the odds?
What are the odds?
Gishtar.
All right, so,
yeah.
All right, so this turkey and side dish thing. First of all, my side dish is my grandmother's cornbread dressing.
Nice.
Thing. Ooh, so, that sounds good.
It kind of is awesome. The pan of it weighs about 47 pounds.
Yes, nice.
It is awesome.
I'm there.
This concept, I think, is what I like to think of as the Maggie Smith rule, mm-hmm. which is, you know, in which any old piece of middling entertainment, including the first Harry Potter film and the original Clash of the Titans, can be enlivened by a bit of British accented asperity.
Nice. Right?
With that in mind, although there's no British accent attached, my first bid was going to be for Heroes. You know, as we have discussed many a time on this show, went bad pretty quickly.
Yes.
And as we have discussed, I am a bitter ender, and yes. I watched all of it.
Yes.
And one thing that I thought, despite all the craziness that, you know, eventually attached to that show, one thing I thought that was consistently pretty good, in fact, I probably would argue that it was a characterization that grew over time and got kind of complicated and interesting, was the character of the Petrelli matriarch, the Angela, I think her name was. She was played by an actress named Christine Rose, and she had layers, and she was an Ishtar.
Mm-hmm. Oh!
Which is a thing I only discovered today and wasn't going to bring up until Weldon mentioned it.
Bringing it full circle.
Exactly.
Bringing it full circle.
The other thing is, and I don't have a whole lot of other specifics, but I had a sort of general principle, which is that in an otherwise brainless romantic comedy, I can be content to admire pretty things and pretty people.
Yes.
It has come to my attention, for instance, that there are people who are not fans of the film Valentine's Day, which I maintain is better than its reputation.
Mm-hmm. Really?
But even if I thought it was complete poo, yes, really, I would still be capable of watching it and thinking, my God, Julia Roberts is a striking species of antelope. and also, oh, Bradley Cooper and Eric Dane, please make us a small indie romance that tells us what happened after the credits of this movie rolls. The fact is, I have very little interest in seeing any of these people on a red carpet or in a magazine spread, but I think what I'm saying is that in the context of a story, even if it's formula, I like a pretty thing prettily framed.
Nice. That's very fair, Trey. Stephen Thompson.
In praise.
Stephen Thompson, a like lovely dish.
I just like Trey Graham in praise of the good looking.
You know, finally, they get a break.
I think we can all be thankful for the prettiest among us.
finally, somebody gives Julia Roberts.
Somebody's got to do it.
And Lenny Riefenstahl.
All right. Ray Thompson.
I'm giving thanks for the fact that this particular podcast contains Truffaut, Riefenstahl, and Vanilla Ice.
Yeah.
I'm certainly tempted to name either Charles Grodin or Carol Kane. Both of whom.
In everything.
Yes. In everything.
First of all, love both of them. Second of all, both of them are in Ishtar.
Yeah, see.
So let's throw out my abiding love of both of those wonderful actors.
You bet.
I would have picked him had we not just done mm-hmm. sort of our favorite character actors, but John Michael Higgins,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
who is a perfect side dish in everything he's in. Musically, I would pick what would be a very obvious choice if this were all songs considered, but
Clem
since
Snide.
It's...
Or maybe not Clem Snide, maybe Eve Parsley.
This would be an obvious choice if this were all songs considered, where we joke about how much we talk about this person. But there have been a lot of recordings with guest performances by Justin Vernon, who we will think of as a meatless substitute.
We will,
in keeping with the Thanksgiving theme. Also, since I forgot to mention, I'm a kind of a sweet potatoes man.
Yeah.
Anything where you whip together a giant mass of sweet potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Also, being a Midwesterner, anything that comes as a large sort of tub of glop.
Okay.
So your baked dish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your casserole, whatever you wish to call it. But if
it has your casseroles with green beans and your mustard.
No green beans. That's empty vitamins.
But if it's like if it's surrounded
noodles?
By condensed mushroom soup.
Yes.
And
noodles,
topped with
condensed soups, cheeses, bacon,
potato chips on top,
corn,
or the fried onion. Thing.
Fried. Yeah. Turkey's
kind
onions.
Of a slurry.
All right. I get it.
Finally, I would like to mention, very briefly brushed past my love of Project Runway Canada.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But did not mention specifically why, which is that in addition to Crazy Pants host Iman,
mm-hmm.
is their Tim Gunn equivalent, or TGE, is a man named Brian Bailey.
Who is awesome.
Who is fantastic. And if you have not yet followed my advice... and track down on YouTube all of Project Runway Canada.
You will not even miss Tim Gunn.
You will not
no.
even... No, I wow. love... And I say that I love Tim Gunn. I love Tim Gunn.
In what way is he like Tim Gunn?
Just watch it. Just watch it.
He is his own brand of kind of loving and kind, but he's not playing a character mm-hmm. who is anything other than a nice person who wants these people to do well. And so he's lovely. And I was specifically reminded of him because during my staycation... I watched season 3 of Project Runway Australia, in which they brought in a man named Alex Perry, who is a, like, purse-lipped, unkind knob.
He's bad.
I wouldn't say he ruins it, because, hey, I'm just watching it, you know?
He's bad, they don't like him.
But a great Tim Gunn equivalent, Brian Bailey, Project Runway Canada, a perfect pop culture side dish.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
He's actually a side dish of a side dish,
right?
If you think of Project Runway Canada
that
as a side
true.
Dish to
that
Project
is true.
Runway.
My favorite actual side dish, I do like the mashed potatoes, but I think in this situation I would single out my mother's pumpkin bread. Good thing about the pumpkin bread is that you can have it at dinner, but then you can also have it like for breakfast. You have a little toasted pumpkin bread.
It's a versatile snack.
And she's usually nice enough to make some with nuts and some without nuts, because I don't like it with nuts in it, so... So mom's very generous that way. In terms of pop culture side dishes, I'm going to mention quickly two people from bad television shows. You all know how much I do not love Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. I nevertheless very much liked Nate Cordry, who is mm-hmm. Rob Cordry's brother. He was very charming on that show, deserved to be swept away to a much better show. I still kind of am waiting for that guy to have his big sort of somebody to find exactly the right thing for that guy to do. He's incredibly, incredibly charming. So that one. And believe it or not, I'm going to pick my favorite person from NBC's revival of Bionic Woman. It was not the Bionic Woman or the Bionic Woman's sister or the Bionic Woman's boyfriend.
It is her powers.
No. Kevin Rankin, who played Herc on Friday Night Lights, so he played Jason Street's wheelchair rugby playing friend, was on Bionic Woman as Nathan, who was the guy who repaired her ear or her knee or her whatever. So she would come in and he would, you know, tweak the technology and all that stuff, and it's like dirty. It's just but he was sort of the wisecracking office bound. You know, he worked in the big sort of secret government compound where she operated out of. And I always found him terribly, terribly charming, exactly as I did when he was on Friday Night Lights and when he's been on a bunch of other stuff. And a good actor who I like, Kevin Rankin. And I used to say, because I recapped that show, I wrote about that show every week, and I used to say, you know, here comes Ear Guy, the only thing the only thing I like on this show.
Here comes Ear Guy.
Hi, Ear Guy. Good to see you again, Ear Guy. So I would definitely to single him out as well. So those are my pop culture side dishes. Okay, you literally have about 15 seconds each to own up to something that you said that you did not mean to say or you would not have said if you had known that it was not true. I'm going to start with myself. I recently talked about Northern Exposure and claimed that it was made by David E. Kelley, who I apparently had it mixed up with Picket Fences. He did not make Northern Exposure. Northern Exposure was done instead by Joshua Brand and John Falsey, and I apologize to them and to everyone involved. Glenn Weldon, made any mistakes recently?
I mentioned in passing that Tintin was French. He's not French, of course. He's Belgian. But in my defense, I think the Belgian's pretty used to that.
Hercule Poirot is really, really angry with you right now.
So that's your confession. Trey Graham, any confessions?
As difficult as it is to admit that I made a mistake on the topic of Queens, I did. As fans of this podcast have noted on our Facebook page, I absentmindedly said Queen Elizabeth when I met Queen Victoria the other week when I was talking about the film Mrs. Brown. Obviously, I knew that Queen Victoria
Perfidy
was the
and
one.
Outrage.
I know.
It was
one of those synapse misfires where you're thinking about one thing and you say another. So I apologize for that to all who were offended. I thought it would be instructive to explore a world in which other such disconnects might exist. Mm-hmm. For instance, what if Orpah, the sister-in-law of the title character in the Old Testament's Book of Ruth, was just trying to live her best life by staying in Moab?
I see what you're doing there.
Also, Steve McQueen, the star of the Thomas Crown Affair, has apparently put on some weight and has begun to affect a British accent.
Mm-hmm.
That one's a little more inside baseball. You have to Google it.
I don't get that at all.
Henry Cavill. Why would anyone raise trivial objections to that?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And one more. What if Doctor Who were on first?
Oh.
Okay.
All right.
It burned.
Stephen Thompson, have you made any mistakes recently?
Well, you know, I was just going to lie belly up and apologize just from the bottom of my heart.
You suggested this whole mea culpa segment.
I suggested this entire mea culpa segment because I had besmirched the good name of Lucy Liu. Because somebody wrote on our Facebook page that, well, Lucy Liu is not in Kung Fu Panda Legends of Awesomeness. And I was like, oh my God, it was right there in IMDb that she's in there. Oh, I'm a fool. Lucy Liu. In Kung Fu Panda Legends of Awesomeness.
At least by everything that we can determine.
You know, certainly if I implied in my initial mention that all of the actors on Kung Fu Panda Legends of Awesomeness are somehow a bunch of nobodies, that would certainly be outrageously false. Stephen Root, Wayne Knight, Wallace Shawn, and others are on Kung Fu Panda Legends of Awesomeness.
All right, so you were forced to have no culpa to Mia.
Yeah, it turns out I am the only one who never misspeaks.
You're the only one who's perfect.
All right.
Wow. So you a culpa.
Yeah, that's
nice.
True. Well, I'm glad we could get that done.
I'm certainly willing to admit when others are wrong.
Well, yeah. And I'm glad. And that brings us to our final part of the show. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, kick it off.
Are you like me, Linda Holmes, and that you lie awake nights thinking, what if Cormac McCarthy wrote Yelp reviews?
That is uncanny.
Yelping with Cormac.tumblr.com.
Shut up.
The brainchild of writer E.D.W. Lynch. I'm going to read from the September 22nd, 2011 entry, Juicy Couture in Union Square, San Francisco. 2 stars. The traveler found himself in a gilded and luminescent valley of commerce beset on all sides by baying signage, the air redolent in fine leather and human urine. He turned and saw behind plate glass 2 mannequins, their alabaster buttocks thrust toward the street, their womanly frames ballooned like some Gaia figurine to be worshipped by savages, and on them were pajama trousers with the word juicy luridly stamped across the seat of the pants. Hellfire and damnation, he said. See, said a drifter standing beside him. The traveler had not noticed the drifter's coming. The man's street-blackened but noble face and vanquished suit coat spoke of a past of finer things. The drifter gestured at the trousers in the window. He began speaking in sonorous Spanish. He told of a world in which no men or women remained, but only nymphs anointed in oils and bedecked in shameful rags, of creatures empty of ambition and godless, pursuing only carnal pleasure, that for their sins they were branded with whorish words on the seat of their trousers, and while the clothes could be removed, the stain of the words would remain forever. The drifter fell silent. The store's double doors opened, and out strode a pair of young women haughty as Romans, their backsides bearing a one-word epitaph for the dreams of those who came before. Yelping with Cormac.tumblr.com.
I love it.
It's making me happy this week and next week and for all foreseeable weeks. It's fantastic.
That is awesome.
That is awesome.
Great choice. Trey Graham, making you happy.
All right. I like this part of the show best when I'm able to talk about something that I absolutely was not expecting. Something that I didn't think about or go looking for. You know, didn't actually do any homework. It just hit me. Something I just ran into and made me smile. And that happened this morning as I was on my way into work. I drove in today, so I was actually listening to this radio show called Morning Edition. And there was a story that did not come from us here at the network, but it was from the local DC member station, WAMU. And it contained this passage.
You can play anything in ragtime.
So he'd also mix in a bit of television.
Mr. Rogers, yeah?
Some video games. Even the movies.
That is the Imperial March from Star Wars, played in stride piano ragtime style. This is where the Lillian Gish reference comes in. I'm hearing this and I'm totally picturing the herky-jerky silent film version with Lon Chaney as Luke and Lillian Gish as Leia fleeing the stormtroopers through a sepia-toned Star Destroyer. Mm-hmm. That is a guy named Martin Spitznagel. Mm. And he lives here in the area, in the Washington area, and he is the reigning world champion of old-time piano.
You should really call it piany.
I kind of should.
Old-time piano.
He has a new album called A Handful of Keys, Face-Melting Ragtime, played by Martin Spitznagel. Seriously, it's kind of awesome. And I have to thank Tara Boyle, who's a producer at WAMU's Metro Connection, for shipping us that audio so we could include it. And we will put up a link to the full interview on the blog. Also, very briefly, as I was poking around our website, the NPR website, looking for ideas about movies I might want to talk about for the turkey and dressing segment, I came across a story about 3D glasses and the technology and the sort of physics thereof on 13.7, which is the NPR Cosmos and Culture blog. It was illustrated with a picture of Queen Elizabeth II in a hat and 3D glasses.
Nice.
And that is all.
Well, I have to say, Trey Graham, I'm pretty disappointed because, frankly, I was going to name my first album Face Melting Ragtime and now I can't. So thanks. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Footnote to Trey's, if you enjoy pianistic renditions of the Mario Brothers theme, search around on the NPR Music website for a song of the day of Mario Solo Piano Medley by Video Games Live and pianist Martin Leung. This particular from an album called Video Games Live. There are lots of little flourishes of wit, as in, mm-hmm. as he's collecting the coins as he goes along, and when he gets an extra life, he'll do a little twinkle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's very impressive.
Awesome.
All right, so what is making me happy this week? Well, we are coming up, as I'm sure those of you with calendars may have noticed, on the end of the year, and this at NPR Music means gorging on all the music we missed, which is always a time-honored tradition, because uh-huh. Right around the corner is just going to be all these wonderful opportunities to discover new stuff, and I've been gorging on albums, you know, sort of late-breaking albums by people like I love, like David Mead and Los Campesinos, and that's been a lot of fun. The return of Dansk Butter Cookies. That's a big deal. I ate an entire tin of them last night while watching the Green Bay Packers.
You know, it's funny. I'd never thought of that as a seasonal food, like the McRib.
It is. And eggnog. I did not douse them in eggnog on the way down my gullet, but I certainly thought about it while watching the Green Bay Packers just absolutely annihilate the hated Minnesota Vikings. Finally, a couple of gift guide recommendations that I'm very excited about, and perhaps we could do a gift guide episode if we had ad reps. I'm sure we would have had to, but because we have no advertising, uh-huh. We do not have to do a holiday gift guide. But the I am T-Pain microphone, I have to obtain. I have not yet obtained it, but I have seen a press release for it, and I'm super excited. It is something that can top back in my AV club days. We used to have a device called the Rapinator, which you could push all these little buttons and it would play like sort of CNC Music Factory style rap phrases over a rap, over a beat. And so it'd be like, boom, ch-chi, boom, ch-chi, boom, ch-chi. Don't stop till you reach the top. Don't stop till you reach the top. Hey, hey, hey. So I'm hoping that the IMT Pain microphone can top it. Also, press release of the day. Styx announces exclusive Diana Warner for Styx jewelry line. So if you love the prog rock band Styx, particularly in its post-Dennis DeYoung form, and you'd like to show that love in jewelry form, please go to DianaWarnerStudio.com to get Styx jewelry for all your loved ones this holiday season.
That is a wonderful recommendation. I hope that you'll get me some. I am going to keep it very simple this week. It's always nice when you discover a TV show of which there are like six accumulated seasons for you to watch that you haven't been watching. I've been watching Bones. It is your basic, you know, boy, girl, solving cases. I never really realized how odd the Emily Deschanel character is on that show. They really do allow her to be an odd duck in a way that you don't find a lot of women in kind of romantic pairings on television who are quite as odd as she is, and I say that in an entirely good way. It's a good show. It's a fun show. And as I said, I always like it when I find something that there's are like a gazillion of them that I haven't seen. And then I just think, oh, well, now I don't have to think again about television for a really super long time.
Does she get odder as the seasons progress? Because I saw the first few episodes and I don't remember her being particularly...
She may get odder as the seasons progress. I have watched some more recent ones.
I would just like to clarify. Are you saying there's a quirky Deschanel on television?
There's one that doesn't bother me. There's one that doesn't fill me with rage. That is progress. And speaking of progress, that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey Graham at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. And you can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music. It makes us happy all the time. And thanks to all of you guys for being here before Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks to all of you for listening. We are taking Thanksgiving week off. We have to eat turkey sometime. And we will see you back here in 2 weeks.